I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from fresh in our original packaging here in 2019. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And today we have a very special guest. We're very excited to welcome Griffin Newman.
Hello, everybody. Hi. I'm so excited to talk about this movie I don't think I can ever talk about on my own podcast.
I don't think you can either.
I feel honored that we're getting to talk about this with you. And I don't mean to, you know, blow smoke up your ass, but I will say that I do feel like it's something that you circle on your podcast so much.
I relate most things to this movie if I can.
And David has clearly no interest in talking about it.
Correct. For a thousand reasons. I think it was always going to be an uphill battle, and then the Lasseter of all made it.
Right. Sure. That'll put
a no-go.
Yeah.
No-go.
That's fair.
We're very excited. Griffin is obviously from the Blank Check podcast. He's also a very big actor right now. He's in The Tick.
I'm a small actor, but yeah.
In stature.
My punctuation was a little weird on that. He's a very big actor, period. Right now he's in The Tick on Amazon.
Season 2 premiering soon. Watch season 1 if you haven't already.
Yeah.
Please.
How are you? Are you healing from your injury?
You know, I'm a little achy today. Thank you for asking. I'm a little achy today. I herniated a disc while filming a dialogue scene on a superhero show.
I can relate
relentlessly on brand. It is one of those weird things. I'm like trying to figure out whether I'm just going to be a back person for the rest of my life. You know what I'm saying?
Yes,
you probably will be. I think
right. And there was a period of time where I was like, oh, I might be like a big problem back person. Like in the immediate aftermath, it was bad, and then it started getting worse and worse and worse. And I was like, am I going to be someone who like is like a limper? Or like, you know, it's like a 30-year-old limper.
You know, like David Milch is a back person.
Sure.
Writes all the scripts laying on the ground, dictating them to some assistant. Yeah. And that's a really bad situation.
It's a baller move, though, just to be clear.
Yeah, I mean, I've steered pretty clear of any opioid addictions.
Pretty clear.
I knew that was like a slippery slope for me. Sure, so I was like, I'm just going to draw a line in the sand. I can't get into back pills.
Here's a question for you.
Yeah.
So as obviously a huge superhero fan.
Big fan.
How quickly did your love turn to hate of your costume?
That's a good question. It's a really good question, and it's a really complicated answer. Okay. I think the things constantly coexist. Like it's a very tough show to make.
Sure.
And it's a very tough costume to wear. I never lose perspective of the fact that I didn't think I would have those problems ever.
Sure.
And I also know why I'm doing it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, this is worth it.
Yep.
I mean, when the days are tough, and much of the cast and crew can attest to this because I do it out loud. I literally repeat to myself, "This is your dream job. This is your dream job. This is your dream job." So that's when it's like really accumulating. I just have to remind myself. No, I mean, I think, like, you know, if I was wearing a costume this difficult on, like, a period film,
sure,
you know, and it wasn't something I cared about as deeply, it would maybe overpower. Mm-hmm. But I'm able to sort of work through the discomfort of it because it's like, this is crazy that I get to wear this.
That cognizance, I think, is important. I think in this industry in general.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean? Like, if you can't remind yourself,
for 15 years.
Yeah. It, I got past the velvet rope. I got in. You know what I mean?
And I feel like I made a profit. Like, I'm good for the rest of my life.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
Do you know?
Sure,
like, sure. This is, like, so beyond what I thought. This is what I set as the insane, like, this would be great if you could play a superhero someday, ready to settle for, like, a 4 on that 10 scale.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a 10 fairly young. So I'm just like, you can't touch me now. I can injure my back and I'm still good, you know? Yeah. But I do think, I mean, it is a weird thing, especially with TV, and I guess it's the same now with franchises and stuff. You learn how to work around the costume. Like, you develop, like, workflows about how you, like, lay in waiting and what pieces you take off. And it's constantly a dialogue of trying to get them to, like, make adjustments.
Sure.
I mean, I came into season 2 with, like, a long list of, like, very specific notes of, like, I think this would help me, and I think this looks bad, you know? Because both things bug me. Like, as much as it's tough wearing the thing, I also get so bugged out if I watch the show and I'm like, the straps are backwards. You know?
Yeah.
Those little things that people, like, obsess over when you watch it.
I'm also looking forward to when you become famous enough that you're like, I won't wear the suit anymore. Like, you basically pull a Jennifer Lawrence and you're like, I'm not doing the fucking makeup. So, like, if you want me on the show.
Yeah. Well, that's also, I mean, the best example of that is the Downey Jr. thing. Where in terms of what they physically make him
he's
wear.
Never in that suit.
Yeah. And we recently rewatched the first Iron Man for Blank Check Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
And there is such a difference when you can tell it is a 42-year-old man in a physically cumbersome thing. And now it's like, you know, it goes from that to being like, okay, the helmet retracts and he only wears the upper torso. Yes, he only wears sort of the breastplate and the shoulders. Yep. To now it's like he puts on sunglasses. The only thing he has to physically touch is a pair of sunglasses, and then the CGI goop goes around him.
Good for him. I mean,
great for him.
So much better than the way it used to be where, you know, Batman, we keep recasting these guys and just pretending it's not that case.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm thrilled to have him in Homecoming in the way he is, just sitting in the back of a car for four scenes.
I also think it's like an interesting arc. I mean, Iron Man 3 is the peak of this idea of like him having this sort of disassociative relationship with this persona that he's created. And so now that he's at this creepy state where it's like they're drones that he's controlling from like, you know, a Del Taco or whatever on speakerphone. I kind of like that. And it also is like that was the cool thing in the comics was that like Iron Man was always getting like sleeker and sleeker and sleeker and sleeker.
Yeah.
It's one example where it doesn't feel like, oh, they're tweaking the Captain America suit again so they can sell new underpants. It like feels like
never
it works
about it
for,
that way.
For the arc. Yeah.
It does. I mean, I have to say, you know, you guys on your Patreon are doing a deep dive into all the Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of rewatching them with you guys. Mm-hmm. I've seen them all at least once in the theater, and some of them I think are good, some of them I don't. But what I do think is interesting is how successfully they've folded these characters into the long term. Like Tony Stark has gone through some really interesting arcs, and they're also kind of hamstrung a little bit by Robert Downey Jr. So to successfully do all of that is impressive.
I agree, and I even think in a weird way the things that bug me in the arcs where I'm just like, they dropped that. Yeah. This was clearly set to be more of a thing, and then it just wasn't tracking or whatever it is. Kind of feels like comic books, where you would just be like, oh, the first issue of this arc is clearly setting up this. By issue 3, they had changed course to some other thing. You know, they found the elements that were clicking. Yeah.
For sure. Well, let's talk about 99, shall we?
Yeah.
Where were you in 99?
I'm a little baby boy, so I was 10 years old.
Okay. Living in?
New York City.
Right.
Downtown Griffinium's.
Downtown Griffinium's, of course.
As people call me.
Do you remember movies that you loved in 99?
Oh, yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
Toy Story 2 being at the top of that
list. Because I was always a movie kid to the exclusion of everything else.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It was like the one thing I kind of got. Like movies and cartoons I was like able to engage with and even the culture around it. And I would just have all these like making of Magica movies, you know, uh-huh. the makeup and the animatronics and all that stuff. It was just like the only thing I understood. And when my parents were going for like parent teacher conferences, they were like, he has to find other things. Like, it's like not healthy that this is the only thing he talks about.
Yeah.
So even by the time Toy Story came out when I was six, I already was a kid who would like schedule my life around when is there going to be a making of special.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
You know, which okay. Disney, I feel like, always did them. Between ABC and the Disney Channel, there would always be a making of special. So anything like that, like the full package of it. And I remember going to see some movie with my mom that I had dragged her to see. It might have been The Big Green or something.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the Toy Story trailer came up and I went, oh, that's my movie.
They made a movie. They finally made a movie.
That's
my movie. Me.
That's the one for me. They finally got my notes, my handwritten letters. I didn't send them. This is everything I want out of a movie.
Right.
So it was like I really called my shot.
Yep.
And then that was my Star Wars.
Right.
But I feel like whereas a lot of people, when they have whatever their Star Wars movie is, where it's like, oh, that's what like turned me on to the thing, they never went deep into movies before that. And it was like right. I was looking for a movie to go that deep into, you know? So then once I had that, it was like all in. I had this like giant like coffee table, hardcover making of Pixar book that was so dense and academic.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents bought it for me because it had like a lenticular cover and they were like, yeah, it's like another picture book. And I would just read this thing and be like, yeah, Ralph Eccleston's art direction was really strong. Like I knew the name of every Pixar
book. Oh, wow.
As like a six-year-old.
Toy Story 2 must have just been the movie that you were
Yeah, I mean, it was like Empire Strikes Back. It was like they're making a Star Wars 2. Are you kidding me?
Right.
And it was the same kind of thing where I remember my father very young saying to me, because I would just keep talking, do you think they're going to do this? Do you think they're going to do that? Like, I was very proud of myself that I was like, Zurg's got to be in the sequel. And people would be like, who the fuck is Zurg? And I was like, when they do a close-up of Buzz Lightyear's packaging on the back, you see the name Evil Emperor Zurg. And I was just like, we all know the Zurg's clearly being teed up for the sequel, you know? Like,
I mean, when you read about the development of this film.
Yes.
And how, I mean, as we all know, it's a miracle when a good movie is made, period.
Right.
It's very hard to make a good movie. But this movie went through so many different iterations mm-hmm. before getting to where we are. You have to wonder whether or not the timeline and how, you know, obviously how tight it was.
Yeah.
Probably helped make this movie as good as it is.
I think so. I mean, that one of my many theories about this film. But, I mean, to circle back around to where I was in 99, mm-hmm. yeah, I feel like I was at this threshold of starting to really engage with, like, a fully adult movies. Like, by this point, I was maybe like, okay, now I'm, like, a full-on Oscar handicapper.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, I'm someone who's reading the Entertainment Weekly issue and trying to break down who the nominees are. Sure. And I'm finally old enough that I'm starting to get, like, you know, limited R-rated movie. You know, my parents will see it first, but they'll vet it and go, this one's, like, a soft R. You can see this. So I'm, like, really seeing all the sort of auteurist 99, you know, last vanguard of, like, the director-driven American cinema films. And Toy Story 2 is, like, maybe this bridge movie where it's like, is this the time to put aside childish things? Mm-hmm. But I'm in no way hiding how much I have invested in the idea of this movie being great.
And I just want to say for the record that a 10-year-old Griffin Newman is like, should I put away childish things?
100%.
But I understand that. That's like...
And I would not put aside childish things even to this day.
I was going to say.
Right, that's the thing. But at this moment, it was, I think, because I wanted to be able to have movie conversations with adults or even teenagers and not lose respectability when I was like, and I'm really excited for like Toy Story 2. You know, like I wasn't embarrassed that I liked it, but I was like, I don't want that to work against like my take on, being John Malkovich or whatever. You know, I don't want it to look like he's a baby. I think that was sort of the fear. So no couched enthusiasm for Toy Story 2, but it also was like, I think a little bit of like, am I going to watch this and be like, oh, I'm not a kid anymore, you know?
Well, I think Toy Story 2 does...
Which I was, clearly, but yeah.
I think Toy Story 2 like kind of occupies a weird space in American cinematic history, which is it was the first animated film that I can remember... Elite critics taking seriously. That and actually Iron Giant.
Yeah.
So the same year these two movies come out, like Toy Story, I think people loved, but I think, and Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, but I think they still looked at it as this is a really beautiful, brilliant kids movie.
Yeah.
Whereas Toy Story, I remember those reviews, and particularly, I mean, it topped a lot of top 10 top 10 list
it,
that
it
year.
It won Best Comedy at the Golden Globes.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it did. Against stiff competition.
Sure, sure.
You know, I mean, it was a big year.
Toy Story 1 won it also, right?
Toy Story 1 didn't. Toy Story 1, I know they gave it, it got nominated for screenplay, and they gave, at the Oscars, they gave it like an honorary award. But that's the thing, was they gave an honorary award for like technical breakthrough.
Yeah.
And you look at so many of the Toy Story 1 reviews, that was the highest grossing film of its year.
Yeah.
Critics clearly liked it, but like,
you know what I think won that year? I think it was Babe.
I think that is true. I think Babe was the thing. Babe was like the critically respected children's film that year. And Toy Story, they were like, that's the blockbuster.
Yeah.
It's clever, but above all else, what a technological breakthrough.
Well, it's so funny. We were talking before we got on mic, Kenny and I, before you got here, we were briefly talking about how if it seems as though they approach Toy Story by saying, if it's just a gimmick, if it's just a technological advancement, who really cares? We still have to make a good movie.
It's Tron. And then it goes away forever, and we never do another
one.
But
like, Toy Story is still a fucking great movie. Like, take away the whiz-bang of it all, it's a great movie.
But what I find sort of stunning to look back at is, like, you watch the Siskel Ebert review of the first Toy Story, and the entire thing is dedicated to how good the surfaces look.
Yeah.
They spend the entire time talking about, like, this really is a marvel. Like, it is just Tron.
Yeah.
And it's like, it wasn't until 2 that retroactively it feels like everyone was like, oh, these things are really well written.
Mm-hmm.
It feels almost a little anomalous that it got a screenplay nomination for the first one, because no one was giving it that sort of credit at the time. And the circumstances through which the movie comes out are, like, so bizarre, because it's, you know, a computer technology company, right, that then George Lucas buys because he thinks there's something there. John Lasseter, having been fired from Disney, goes to not a CES, but one of those sorts of conferences, sees the demo reel and goes, like, I think I could do this. And they bring him on as, like, I don't know, let's have this be one of the 18 things we're trying to do. Let someone make shorts.
Yeah.
And then the shorts start working, and people think they're funny, and he brings in Pete Docter and Andrew Stanton, and they build the original team. George Lucas sells it. He's like, look, I don't see much value here. After they had said, like, we'd like to make a movie, and he's like, I don't think that's the thing. But by all means, see if you can find a buyer.
Which is shocking.
Insane.
He'd be so short-sighted, considering that he's a man who, obviously...
Yeah.
Okay. Well, technologically,
he's so good at doubling down on like the future of the thing.
Yeah,
yeah, that's definitely true. But I think what we're kind of getting at is he probably saw the value in the technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the idea of, can we marry story to this technology, that I think seems like a bridge too far for him. I don't want to shit on George Lucas.
Yeah.
You know how I feel about episode one. I think, like...
And we know how Griffin
feels. I know feels how you guys feel about
it. I mean, it is the best of the Phantom Menace. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that has nothing to do with George Lucas, but I can see that. I can see him saying, this may not work.
Right.
Yeah.
But Jobs doubles down, which is even weirder because it's, here's a guy with no story background, only technology, and he sees the value of this as a storytelling tool.
It's kind of incredible. I mean, and Jobs, he was involved till his death, right? Like, is Apple still – they're still involved in the company, I imagine, to some extent, right?
Well, no, because they sold fully to Disney.
Oh, right, sorry.
But it ended – I mean, he was still very advisory in all levels, creatively, technologically, business-wise, until his death. And he died the largest independent shareholder of Disney.
It's incredible.
Because that was buyout for Pixar. You know, so he was very hands-on at both Disney and Pixar until his death.
That's amazing.
They said that he consulted on everything until he died.
I mean, he was instrumental from a sort of bargaining and negotiation perspective as well, in terms of like how they negotiated with Disney and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
It's pretty fascinating. It's the history of Pixar, which, you know, we could do an entire podcast just on Pixar, but it is just fascinating to see how this film also was kind of folded into that whole like. Sequels, no sequels.
Right. This is the whole crazy thing. And that's another thing that I think this movie totally changed. I think this movie shifted the entire sequel conversation at least 30 degrees in American cinema. But So, I mean, from that point, Jobs buying, they go to Disney, pitch them a Christmas special because they were like, we want to do a long form animated thing. I think Lasseter had won 2 Oscars already at that point for shorts. So it was clearly like there was something working there. And they said, look, if you can do half an hour, why not just do an hour? Because the original Toy Story is like
80-something minutes?
With credits.
With credits, yeah.
Right. It's like very short.
Yeah.
So there was – I mean the legacy – because both of these movies, I think it's key that they came out of like real struggles to make them work. Like, they kept on almost dying. That they were trying to acquiesce to all the Katzenberg notes, which in retrospect were all the things he later would do at DreamWorks. Mm-hmm. Where he's like, I want to do an animated movie that's, like, really for grown-ups. Like, pop culture jokes, edgy, you know, like, it's, like, movie star-driven, using their personalities and different-looking bodies.
God,
like,
Shark Show. Isn't it depressing that that kind of worked?
I mean, not, I know, not, but it's crazy.
Depressing that worked commercially.
Yeah. Because
it's so cynical.
Right. Yeah. It's so cynical, but there's, like, 10% of the residue of what he was trying to do that I think positively impacts Toy Story. Mm-hmm. And they were so defined by, like, everyone views animation as only what Disney does. And the few studios who have tried to step up to the plate just try to do Disney, essentially. And there was not, until the Rugrats movie, an American animated film that grossed over $100 million that wasn't released by Disney.
Quick sidebar. Is there a chance of you guys actually doing a Don Bluth?
Yeah. I would love to.
I would kill for it.
I mean, it's a fucking crazy career.
Oh,
it is a crazy career.
Yeah, 100%.
Not to get too far in that direction, but, you know, I have three little children, and Don Bluth movies come up every once in a while.
Yeah.
They're fascinating.
They're weird.
They're so weird. The animation looks like nothing else I'd ever seen, and they really are an interesting alternative to everything Disney did for the last 80, 90 years.
Right.
So I would...
I mean, I loved
one vote here. Couldn't believe it was on. Couldn't believe it was on the March Madness thing.
So, we had that idea late, and we were like, "Oh fuck, we have to throw him on there." And I think I mean, I'm hoping more people rally behind him this year. But yeah, I mean, you look, Bluth was so weird, but it felt like what he was trying to do was, this is how Disney should have evolved with the times. Like, it was still the Disney formula, but he was trying to, like, advance it, you know, and add more artistry to it.
I mean,
and Pixar comes up with a list of, like, all the things we're not doing. It's not a fairy tale. It's not a musical, you know?
There's only, I mean, there's one song in each of these movies. Am I wrong in that? Toy Story and Toy Story 2?
The first one has like three, but they're just Randy Newman singing.
They're not sung by characters.
Right.
It's funny because
this one has the Sarah McLachlan song, obviously.
Right.
Tarzan is also this year, which is the first Disney movie that doesn't have their characters singing songs.
Right.
It's all Phil Collins songs.
Right.
So it's
weird too.
Yeah, it seems as if Disney is a little kind of retroactively,
and the two songs that the characters kind of sing, they're sort of one foot in, one foot out. Where it's like they have Glenn Close sing a lullaby to Tarzan,
Right.
Well, it's not like a musical number. It's like a mother does that.
Yeah,
and then there's that weird Rosie O'Donnell song where she's like scatting while they're like trapped in a human camp.
Yeah, that's a weird moment in that movie.
But most of the song
feels diegetic in its own way.
It's Phil Collins over the film in his own voice,
and he also just. It was pretty clear that Phil Collins is like, here are five songs. I don't really care if they have anything to do with the story.
Right.
Another depressing thing that it beat this song. We've hit most of the songs now that were nominated. This is the
one that should have won.
Right.
Well, yeah. This is, I mean, the Jesse moment in this movie, I think it's the saddest moment in Pixar to me. I mean, there's a lot of them. I know the opening of Up, and there's a lot. I mean, don't get me wrong, Wally, I basically cry through most of that movie.
Yeah.
But this. There's something about how
we should rank our top five favorite saddest moments in
Pixar. I don't know. There's something about the sadness of it, and Jesse's a really sad character.
Agreed. And maybe my favorite character in the history of cinema.
When he opens the box at the end, and she's in the fetal position, and you're just like, Jesse, keep it
together. I think there's a lot of very subtle characterization that doesn't get enough credit in how they depict Jesse as like a survivor of trauma.
Yeah.
And when she starts having her panic, it's like, I can't go back in the box. Jesse.
But that's the thing. I think this movie doesn't get enough credit in the Pixar canon. Because there is a weird amount of restraint.
Yeah.
This is when they're starting to tackle more adult things a little more aggressively, psychologically.
Yeah.
And that the Jesse sequence, I just think, pulls back in such a way that it hits you harder because you're just like, this isn't clearly teeing me up to like cry.
The look on her face when she's back in the thing, you're just like, fuck.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really good. And also, I mean, Sarah McLachlan's very good at pulling heartstrings, so like you've got this marriage of those two things.
Yeah,
and how sun-kissed it is, and all of it is just.
And
like,
you go, Randy Newman sings all three songs in the first movie.
Yeah.
Then A Bug's Life, they have his song, which is in the end credits, but he sings it, and it's like they've established a model now that's like Randy Newman writes songs that play over the action.
Yeah.
And for him to be like, I shouldn't sing this.
This is not one for me.
And I love Randy Newman, but it was like such a good call to be like, I'm not the tenor that this needs to have.
Yeah. It's a really beautiful moment. And she's a beautiful character, which, I mean, from some of the research I did, seems to have been pushed by Lasseter's wife, in fact, saying that there's no strong women in your... Which I think is really interesting. You know, she is one of the best female characters they've ever done.
Yeah.
In Pixar.
Yeah.
And John Cusack so perfectly voices it. It's just, it's
they've done so few. I mean, in the last few years, there've been more.
Yes.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
Brave being maybe the one of the bigger ones.
Yeah, but Inside Out is really that's the strongest because you have like two female leads inside a third female lead.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it really is. Those are the three principal characters.
For sure.
And Mrs. Incredible, I think Elastigirl, yes. I keep on calling her Mrs. Incredible and people rake me over the coals for it. They don't know that it's a joke. How does he not know that? I know her name's Elastigirl. I just like calling all of them blank incredible, like sure. It's their last name.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a very brief synopsis for the five people that might not have seen Toy Story 2 and are listening to this podcast. Woody, played by Tom Hanks, is stolen from his home by toy dealer Al McGuigan, played by Wayne Knight, also perfect voice casting, leaving Buzz Lightyear, played by Tim Allen, and the rest of the gang to try to rescue him. But when Woody discovers that he's actually a valuable collectible from a once popular television show called Woody's Roundup and is reunited with his horse, Bullseye, Jessie, the yodeling cowgirl, played by Joan Cusack, and his faithful sidekick, Stinky Pete, the prospector, played by Kelsey Grammer, he doesn't want to leave. So Toy Story 2 was released on November 19th, 1999, in first place, as you can imagine, $57.3 million, which today would be over 100, I'm assuming.
Right, and the 5-day was even bigger. The 5-day was even bigger. Yeah, right. I just remember being like, I remember being the front cover of the New York Post.
It had a weird thing where it was released 2 days early in like two theaters, and then it opened wide
Disney
for Thanksgiving.
Disney used to do that, where they wanted to prestige it up and be like,
platform it in
limited,
some way.
Right.
It would go on to make just shy of $500 million worldwide, which, you know, obviously today would be $700 or $800 million. It's crazy. We spoke earlier as well that it had a perfect score on Rotten Tomatoes until last year when it was dethroned by Paddington 2.
Which is just, it was dethroned because Paddington 2 had a larger number of perfect reviews.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is just the modern landscape.
Exactly. So we have you here.
Yeah.
So we kind of have to do the box office
game. Sure. Yeah.
If you're open to doing that.
Yes, most definitely.
So it's opening weekend. We're going to do when it opened wide as opposed to...
Well, let me say to you, one of the two weekends, I can't remember if it was the limited weekend or the wide weekend, is the weekend that Ride with the Devil came out, which I know we did cover on the podcast. So I would say let's do the other one.
This is the other one.
Great. Perfect. Yes. Amazing. What a pro. Great.
So in this weekend, number one. With a bullet.
Okay, so this is their wide weekend,
The second is, did very well. It's in its second weekend. It is also a franchise film. It had, what's a good?
This is Thanksgiving 99.
I'm not looking at it.
Oh, you're not looking at it?
I'm playing at home.
Was it World Is Not Enough?
It is. World Is Not Enough.
Okay.
Good. There would be a ding if we had a ding. There would be a ding. In third place, its first weekend... a huge movie star, an action movie star.
Interesting. Okay.
Not really an action film, more of a genre piece.
So he's trying to grow a little bit, maybe? No?
Maybe. I mean, it's. I will say this. It's not a great movie. It did pretty well. Made $20 million in its first weekend. Wow. It would go on to do pretty well.
Have we covered it?
We have not covered it. It has...
Would you
elements.
Ever cover?
Well, we're covering.
We
all
have to
of
cover every movie of 1999.
Oh, really? Wow.
That's the conceit of the
that
podcast.
Is the conceit of the podcast.
It's nice to have like a goal for the rest of your life. Right. Okay.
It is approximately 250 films.
Okay.
And then on top of the fact that we also will be covering some television
TV
shows, so The Sopranos, West Wing, Freaks and Geeks.
Okay. Crazy.
We'll be doing this for a while. I would say Gabriel Byrne is in it.
Oh, it's End of Days?
It is End of Days. Okay. Sorry if that
no,
tipped
no,
it for you.
No, you're right. And you're right. It isn't really branching out. it's him going out of his sweet spot, but also not branching out in any meaningful
way. Yeah, it's like Schwarzenegger Fights the Devil.
Right.
Which, by the way, like I saw it in the theater.
Yeah.
It's not a good movie, but I saw it because Schwarzenegger Fights the Devil.
But it was one of those things where you're like, you just imagine someone walking and go, here's my pitch, Schwarzenegger Fights the Devil, and you go slam dunk. And then that movie, it's like, this is like a little too pretentious.
It is.
Without being smart, like it's like moody and not like campy fun.
Also, like, weirdly, Schwarzenegger, at least in my head, always fights like tactile things.
Yes.
If that makes any sense.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So he was fighting, like, he's not a supernatural guy.
Unless he's in some other world.
Right.
But if he's in you know, Total Recall or right. something along those lines.
Right.
But if he is terrestrial, he is fighting other terrestrial beings.
Right.
Right, but your point is that, like, that movie veers a little too into, like, Hellblazer, Constantine territory. Yeah, Constantine.
Exactly.
Like,
which is not where I see where Schwarzenegger lives for me.
Not really where I want him.
Right.
But
Number four is was number two the weekend previous. It was notorious, I guess, because both of the films that opened did very, very well. They were like neck and neck.
Sleepy Hollow.
It is Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah. Big movie for all of us.
Big movie for everybody.
Yeah.
And then number five is a franchise I know nothing about, which your friend Michael Natale is going to come on for.
Oh, interesting.
Did you skip? Did you skip one? Because now I'm looking at it.
No.
Oh, okay.
Number.
This is
five.
The weekend of the 26th. I don't know which weekend you're looking at.
But I'm looking at December. That's all the same films for 2 weeks.
It's crazy.
But the order just
It's, it, now right. I don't know where it falls in this oeuvre.
Okay,
we're I guess, and this might tip you, but like we're going to be getting a reboot of this summer.
A reboot of this summer. It's a 99.
Yeah.
Interesting. How many films are there in total, including the new reboot? You don't know. You don't know.
There are so many because I don't even know.
Dozens?
Dozens.
Literally dozens.
Literally dozens?
I don't know how many have been theatrically released, but dozens.
I believe this was the first one released here.
I think it was either one or two. I think it was one, but it was either one or two.
Whoa!
That maybe should be a hint.
It should
in and of
be
itself.
A hint. Of,
yeah, that's so specific.
It's it is a very interesting franchise that has spawned toys and games. This does feel very Griffin.
My wheelhouse. Yeah, toys and games.
Toys and games.
Yeah,
it's as popular today.
Yeah,
as
I was just
going to
say
been.
It had a big resurgence.
Oh, it's Pokemon the first movie. Yeah, of course.
Do you know
of
if
course.
That was the first or the second?
That is the first. It's called. It's literally called Pokemon the first movie.
But
I wasn't sure.
2000.
That's the second one.
Around the same time.
That's the second one. It comes out like 6 months later.
Okay.
Because they had already released like four in Japan at that point.
Yeah.
They released all of them in America within like an 18-month span.
Yeah. But yeah, so Michael's coming on for that. He's very excited. I know nothing
about
Pokemon.
I'm very excited too.
Kenny's very excited.
Well, like, I'll say, like, that was, you talk about like putting aside childish things. I was in the perfect age sweet spot for Pokemon.
Yeah.
Pokemon Fever was like so all consuming.
You're like,
I think it was like one of those last moments where our culture was monolithic, that if there was a kid trend, everyone had to be into it.
Sure.
Like
now
kids can find their own lane and like whatever, but it was like, everyone had to fuck with Pokemon in 1999.
It felt that way.
And I remember making my dad take me and my brother Jamesy to see the movie and sitting there and being like, I think I'm done with this. Like,
really?
You saying that, oh, 10 sounds young for you to feel like you have to put aside childish things. I was sitting there in Pokemon. I go, I can't be doing this any longer.
Really?
Yeah, it just felt like this is the end of this thing.
Do you think it's because my detachment from Pokemon has more to do with it feels like a cultural divide.
Yeah.
There's something, and I like anime. I'm very excited for us to cover Princess Mononoke on the podcast.
Old.
I know, but I'm just saying that
as am I,
that there's something very kind of surreal and strange and almost kind of like there's some sort of a translation that's being lost a little bit. That I wonder if that might have had something to do with it as well. Or as a kid, did you just not even tap into that stuff? And you're just like,
it was such a weird thing. I mean, it was just, it's like this perfectly designed franchise.
It is.
Because of, and it just feels like they stumbled into it and now people try to recreate it to mixed effects.
Sure.
But it always feels reverse engineered from the end point. But the gotta catch them all thing.
Yeah.
You know, the way it existed in, like, you know, it's a game where watching the episodes of the TV show contextualize how badly you want to win these characters, but also the cards.
Yeah.
You know, there were so many different outlets to it where the idea of, like, I think it was also, like, in a weird way, it was like sports for nerds. Where it was like
that's
you understand the relative stats of these things and the dream scenarios of how they would work together.
It's very smartly put
and then
together.
You craft this very basic hero's narrative onto it where it's like a little kid from a small town. I mean, he's like essentially Luke Skywalker and he dreams something bigger and he goes off and becomes a master. And then I think there's this thing where when you get older, everyone looks at it and goes, wow, this premise is so fucked up.
Yeah. And now, obviously, you make him a detective. That's the obvious.
Right, that's the obvious next step.
The obvious next step.
The obvious next step.
So
I think you'll like – Pokey. I think you'll like going into the world of Pokemon when we do a little more than you
I don't doubt it for a second. I don't doubt
like
it.
As my kids have, because my son is 6 and a half is like super into Pokemon.
Right.
And I've had to watch every one of these movies. And I've been shocked at the emotional depth contained with
I'm excited. These movies. It's an ocean I don't know anything about. Yeah, I was being the eldest at this table. I was 19 in 1999. Mm-hmm. So Pokemon was just not something that really
right. Yeah, of course.
I still loved Toy Story because again, I think it hits you on different levels.
And it's a real movie. Like I will not defend Pokemon the first movie for a millisecond.
Okay, that's good. So I want to read just a brief portion of Roger Ebert's review of this film.
Okay.
Because I think it taps into something that I want to talk to you about.
Yeah.
I forgot something about toys a long time ago, and Toy Story 2 reminded me. It involves the love, pity, and guilt that a child feels for a favorite toy. A doll or an action figure or a Pokemon is yours in the same way a pet is. It depends on you. It misses you. It can't do anything by itself. It needs you and is troubled when you're not there. Toy Story 2 knows this, and for smaller viewers, that knowledge may be the most important thing about the film, more important than the story or the skill of the animation. This is a movie about what you hope your toys do when you're not around and what you fear. They have lives of their own, but you are the sun and the sky of their universe, and when you treat them badly, their feelings are wounded. And I think that really hits home for me, at least in terms of seeing the emotional depth of this movie, of this series, and which goes even darker in the third one, and it's basically all about death. This film is about a lack of love and detachment and
betrayal.
That's
betrayal.
Also why I think this one's the darkest. And I think people are surprised when I say that, but it's because I think it's not as overt as 3. I think everything that 3 like directly addresses in a way people were like, oh my God, I can't believe how like mature they made it. It's like baked into the cake in Toy Story 2 and they're not even mentioning it. You know?
It's true.
Which makes it more dark. Like the fact that they're not calling out Jesse's psychological complex thoroughly.
Sure, mm-hmm. sure.
You know?
Or when, I mean, even just like there's moments in it, rewatching it the other night, where like when Woody gets shelved, and everyone's like, they shelved him. And it's like, and he like pulls his legs up from the, it's just like, it's really, really dark.
And I remember just seeing that in a theater and hearing the adults in the audience gasp. You know, and it's like one of these movies, it's this thing that Pixar can do where they can just establish the relative stakes for this character.
Yeah.
Here's the language of this is the worst thing that could possibly happen is being shelved, and they make it hit like so hard. Inside Out does the same thing with like the emotion balls where it's like the first time sadness touches one of them, it starts turning blue and the whole audience goes like, oh, fuck.
Yep.
And you're like, that shouldn't matter to any of us. You're just changing a ball a color.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like Paddington 2 with the pop up book. It's like
I still
this
haven't
is
seen
why
the Paddington movies. I apologize. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I can curse on the show, right?
Of course. Yeah. Absolutely. Crazy.
They fuck.
I hear they're incredible.
Yes. I got too long winded and too big picture with this, but I think you know the relative hurdles that the two Toy Story movies had to overcome. One with Katzenberg trying to shove all the stuff down them. They had the screening with the story reels, which for those who don't know, with Pixar they do and animation they do this. You put the whole movie in storyboards. You have scratch voices, or maybe the actors have started recording. And so they watch the whole thing cut together with the temp soundtrack before they start animating, because animation is so expensive, you're not going to get multiple takes to choose from. So they want to make sure it works. And they did this screen that everyone said was, like, disastrous.
Right.
Like, pin drop nightmare. And they walk out, and Disney was like, well, the movie's canceled. We're not making this. Incredible. And they, like, got on their knees and were just like, give us a weekend. And they went back and, like, didn't sleep and said, like, what's the exact movie we want to see? So it's one of those things where they just had to, like, go to their basic instincts, fight so hard, why do we like this premise in the first place, and just dug into it. It forced them to do all the hard work of this thing, which is when I was 6 and I saw the trailer for the first one, I went, yeah, finally, a movie about all the concerns that I have as a child. You know, how much emotional investment you put into your toys, and I think you do this transference, or your relationship to your toys reflects your fears of how the world views you and your parents view you and whether you'll be wanted and loved and cared for and attended to, whether your value will retain. I mean, all these sorts of things.
The projection of all those things.
And I mean, the literal version of it is when like kids want a baby doll and want to pretend like they're parenting. But I think it transfers to everything. I mean, I was talking to my girlfriend, Humblebrick, about like, you know, she was saying that she had so many stuffed animals and that she would rotate which one she slept with because she felt like she didn't want to show favoritism.
So does my son. I understand that. That's
right.
Real.
Yeah. Right. And I was like, I had my like top tier guys who would lie on the bed, and I wouldn't necessarily physically sleep with them, but I was like, you're here.
Right. You're allowed on the bed. You
got some job security. I mean, all that sort of stuff. You make up all those kinds of rules, and I think they are reflections of your relationship with the world. And I think the first one is very much about being a child and hitting that point where you realize how much bigger the world is than you. Which often happens for kids when a sibling is born. True. And that's what the first Toy Story is really about. It buzzes the hot new sibling, and his entire world is thrown into chaos, and then they actually find themselves stuck in a larger world that doesn't care for them, doesn't look for them. Toy Story 2, which, you know, after Toy Story 1 so big, Disney has been cranking out video sequels. That's Eisner's whole game. And they went, obviously, we need a Toy Story 2. They only had the deal for the first Toy Story. Jobs negotiates a five-picture deal that was five original movies. Sequels don't count. And they were like, look, if any of these work, we're going to crank out some shitty DTV thing. You got to make five original movies for us. And so they were like, you guys work on the next thing, A Bug's Life. This is still the period where Pixar is like an all-hands-on-deck company, where it's pretty small and everyone works on one movie, which I think is key. I'm not trying to distance this movie from auteur theory just because Lasseter is a creep.
Yeah.
But I also think you look at this movie and the first one and A Bug's Life, and then you look at Cars, and you're like, you can't give Lasseter all the credit for these three.
Yeah.
Because clearly it was the fact that he had every good story person, every good animator. He's got
brilliant people around him.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Stanton, by all accounts, was the main writer on these two movies, and that's when he became like the key story guy at Pixar who will, you know, understood. Because they would hire outside comedy writers to try to write these movies. They went through like six writers. I think they're five or six credited. Including Joss Whedon, who they said was the first guy who kind of cracked it for them but couldn't stay on long. And Andrew Stanton was like, I think at this point I'd like to have a go at it. And he ran with it. They are all working on A Bug's Life, and they were like, toss off a premise for Toy Story 2. And they toss it off. They give it to a couple of their junior guys. The B-team's working on that, which they barely have a B-team to spend. And they go all in on A Bug's Life. And that movie ends, you know, it's doing well, victory tour, they end the press tour. Lasseter says, whether or not it's apocryphal, that he, when he was flying back to go watch the first screening of Toy Story 2, he saw a little boy with a Woody doll, realized, like, oh, this is, these characters mean this much to these people, I can't let this be shitty. There's money to be made.
Yeah.
Right. I used to tell myself that I was that boy. Because no one could ever disprove it. It's very possible. I carry that doll with me everywhere. Certainly to the airport. Who knows? Could have been me.
So you had a Woody doll?
Oh, yes.
Did you have a Buzz doll?
I did.
Did you have, like, of the toys that existed, did you have the whole gang, or?
I had most of them. Yeah, I mean, I
remember wanting a Rex, and I don't think I ever
The Rex stuff was limited, and I had a small Rex.
Yeah.
They didn't make a good comprehensive, here's everyone in the correct scale relative to each other with the right materials until Toy Story 3. I would say I had some representation of every main character.
The right materials are key. You can bring a Woody doll anywhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you have a character who you related to the most?
Woody, 100%. Woody, 100%. Really? And then with two, I think it then shifted over to Jesse, perhaps. But that was the thing, was like, the fact that in Toy Story 1, Woody becomes so petty that he becomes such an asshole.
I don't think I could
break this at the time, but I was like, this is the first animated film where the characters act like adults.
Well, he's Richard Dreyfuss in What About Bob,
right?
Basically, right?
Right.
Like, Buzz Lightyear comes in, he's a bumbling idiot who doesn't understand reality, and everyone's so charmed. I mean, for me, Buzz Lightyear's like one of my favorite characters in the history of cinema, and I love that this movie gives you old Buzz and new Buzz.
It's the best. It's such
a smart conceit. But yes, the fact that Woody becomes driven by petty jealousy, you know, and that there isn't like a clear moment where he monologues and explains, like,
and his friends see it too and call him out on it. You know what I mean? Like, they're like, well, what's up with you? Like, why are you acting this way? Which I think is really, I mean.
But what's so great about that, I mean, Griffin, to your earlier point, what's so great about that is, like, all the toys, and you look at the entire series, all the toys have the same goal.
Yeah.
I just want to be loved by the person who owns me or bought me or my person. Even Lotsa, right? Even like the bad toys.
Right.
Just have the same goal. So it's really kind of heartwarming in the end of the day that Woody's just doing it for Andy's love.
Well, and that's why I think these movies are so existential, because they really are like, who do we want to be? Like, what do we want out of life?
Yeah.
And what are our greatest fears?
Yeah.
And I think Toy Story 2 is the movie. So here's the other thing. They go to the screening. They see it. It's a nightmare. Lasseter and the Pixar group go to Disney and they go, we can't release this. And Disney goes, you don't understand. It doesn't fucking matter. It's called Toy Story 2. We'll put it out on VHS and we'll make $100 million. Yeah. It doesn't matter. And his pitch to them is, if you give us a six-month extension, if you give us a year, we will redo the entire movie and make it good enough to release in theaters, which at the time was not done. There's one theatrical Disney sequel. It's The Rescuers Down Under.
Yeah, why is that?
The explanation was that when Eisner came in and was like, we got to exploit the brands, and this speaks to a weird sort of integrity that doesn't exist today, he was like, oh, God damn it, all these other movies end with happily ever after. The Rescuers is the only one that feels like it could be kind of serialized.
Right.
And of course, they end up making direct-to-video sequels to all those movies later, right, explaining why the happily ever after wasn't happily ever after, whatever. But
non-canon to some extent.
And sequels were certainly seen as a lesser thing. They mostly happen to like franchises where it's like cop movies, right, you know, or like things like that, horror films where it's just
and it's
just
cheaper.
Like,
the straight-to-video is cheap, right? Very, so like very releasing cheap. A movie theatrically is very expensive. So I understand, but like Disney of all places, you're
right. What's kind of lovely about this point, this idea is, in general, sequels are garbage, right?
Yes.
In general, sequels are, you know, Jaws 3D.
Yeah.
Occasionally, sequels are Godfather 2.
Right.
Or Empire Strikes Back.
Or Babe Pig in the City.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, there is a history of, if you nail the sequel, you've had the greatest cinematic achievement possible.
Yeah.
So there is that North Star to shoot for.
Well, and that's...
Which I think they are. Pixar is looking at it that way for sure, 100%.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like Lasseter is like... Yeah. I'm going to try to make my Godfather 2, my Empire,
swing
whatever.
They're just holding themselves to insane standards on this movie. Yeah. And it's like a year of people not sleeping. Like all the stories you hear about this
and
movie.
And being injured, apparently. Like there were a lot of people with carpal tunnel and any number of things. I know you're laughing, but seriously.
Conditions that lasted for the rest of their life.
I don't mean to laugh at it. I mean, but it's just
people
it's
are
true.
Like fucking is, like leaving their kids in cars.
This is like when Griffin gets his dialogue injury.
Yes, yes, 100%. Yeah. No, truly. And
because you're working hard.
There are all these crazy stories where the entire movie almost got deleted.
Well, that 80% that's the craziest story that I read.
They found out that someone had it on a backup floppy disk. Like, otherwise, the movie would not exist.
Just gone.
They would have had to start
like
over.
Someone
a
happened
third
to
time.
Be at home like, with their kid. Like, just happened to be at home and they had it. It's so crazy.
Yeah, all those emails.
I mean, it's just nuts.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sorry. I didn't mean to breeze past that.
There are two things going on here. You know, one is I think they're holding themselves to insane standards.
Yes.
And I think part of in the same way they had these chips on their shoulders. These were guys who didn't figure out how to make it through the traditional Disney system, despite being CalArts guys, where that was just the pipeline to going to Disney. They didn't fit in there. They started their own studio. You know, they amass in numbers. People don't believe they can make shorts. They don't believe they can make commercials. They don't believe they can make features. Yeah. And so at this point, they're just really vindictively trying to prove everything.
Everyone wrong. Yeah.
Right. And Toy Story 2, it's like, okay, let's try to change that thing, that sequels suck, that they can't matter, that they're crass, that they're cash-ins, any of that sort of stuff. And I remember my father saying to me when I was like, what if in Toy Story 2, when I was in like the three-year lead-up, you know, and I kept on hypothesizing, and my dad said to me, Griff, I just need you to understand.
It might not be good.
This is
so good.
I have this very distinct memory of him just being like, you need to be prepared for the fact that it probably will not be good. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he was like, sequels are not good. And he was like, Godfather 2. And I was like, I don't even know what that is. What are you talking about?
And just he like, was like, David's trying to make sure that you don't lose it for Toy Story 4.
Right. And he was like, I don't know. Like, most sequels aren't better. And I was like, what are you talking about? What about Ghostbusters 2? And he was like, most people don't think Ghostbusters 2 is as good.
Do you think
I didn't understand. At that point, I was like, these are both movies I watch on TV.
I think it's good today. So
I think it's fun. Like, there are a ton of movies like that where I just, like, didn't understand relative values of sequels and originals and what have you. And he was like, you have to be prepared for this. So much of this movie, I can intellectually break down why I still think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
But it also is, I don't want to sound too depressing when I say this. I just, there's such a undivorceable context of me sitting there in the theater and going, this is probably the best I'm ever going to feel. Because I will never have higher expectations for anything, and they're surpassing them so wildly. The relief and the sort of, like, victory, like, pump my fist, like, they're doing it. They're doing it, like, on a scene-to-scene basis. And this movie is so tight.
Oh,
it was
God.
Forged in fire. I knew that it was supposed to be directed. Like, all these things, you know?
You know, that moment you're talking about, I remember having that exact same feeling with a very weird thing. Remember when Prince played the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
Sure.
And no one, there's never
the, been the rain? The Beyonce one you're talking about?
No.
Or the first one?
It was, when it was raining,
when
right?
When it was raining.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
They dropped the drape and they had, yeah. And he had, and there'd never been a good Prince, yeah. There'd never been a good halftime show.
Sure.
Ever.
Yeah.
And all my friends are sitting there and they're, Prince, whatever. I'm crazy about Prince. And I'm just like, no, he's going to do it. He's going to do it.
Yeah.
And the rain came down and the drape came down and he has his guitar and I stand up and I go, fuck you guys.
Right. And you know, like, I'm not a sports guy, but I'm obsessed with the story of the Michael Jordan flu game. And it's that feeling where, right, when you're just like, this is a great game regardless.
Yeah.
But if you're invested in the fact that it's like, Andy has the flu, like, you understand what went into it.
Yeah.
And so there's that element to Toy Story 2. But the other thing is you have to think of how much – all the people at Pixar have sacrificed at this point to, like, pull all-nighters. I mean, when you read the number of, like, Toy Story 1 costs, like, $40 million, and it's, like, that's because it was made by, like, 15 people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's – the way you save money is just manpower, and everyone just lost their minds making that movie. Then they go straight into a second movie, and then they go straight into taking over a third movie. So they're also now at this point making a movie about trying to figure out their relationships to their family because I think this is the key of, like, the existential shift in Toy Story 2 – is like now it's not about being a child and wondering whether your parent will love you forever and whether you'll have a place in the world and whether the outside world will care about you as much as your home did and all of that. Now it's about being a parent and wondering whether your child won't care about you. Whether you've ruined that relationship, whether they'll learn to be independent of you, you know, whether you fucked it up and now you're stuck on a shelf or now you're at a museum in Japan. And I do think the central paradigm of the thing that Stinky Pete the prospector proposes to
Woody. You really are Stinky Pete.
Yep. Where he says to him, like, what do you want? You go to Andy, you get a few more good years. Yeah. But is he going to bring you to college?
Or and on this, his honeymoon.
Right. And this is, like, the subtext thing. Everyone gets the feels for Toy Story 3, which I do too. I'm not backhanding it because it makes the college thing literal. But for me, when Stinky Pete says that, I get shivers. Because what's scarier is the notion of sitting at that moment and not knowing how it's going to play out. And the alternate is you go to a museum and everyone will love you forever for the rest of time. But is it really real? You have a lot of transactional love.
I want to take that point. So if one, and I agree, one is about being a child, two is about being a parent.
Yeah.
I think three is about being a boyfriend or girlfriend. I think
interesting.
I always think three is and I think if you look at this through the lens of Jesse's
relationship with Buzz.
With Emily.
Yes, but in the third one, I thought you meant with Buzz.
It has nothing to do with Jesse and Buzz for the most part. It's really about toys and their owners, however you want to say it. But Jesse's relationship with Emily is a relationship between two people who are in an emotional relationship.
Yeah.
It breaks up, and she can't move on.
Right.
Right? And she can't move on until she finds Andy, and it's all kind of seated there. In Toy Story 3, they're all breaking up with Andy. Every one of them is breaking up with Andy, and we've all gone through breakups. Breakups feel like you're about to die.
Other than Woody. I mean, three is the one where Woody becomes, like, fully delusional. And after being the leader for two movies, that he just won't accept it.
Because he really was in that relationship with Andy, and it really is ending for him, and it really does feel like
– that's a really good
take. I don't know where I'm going to go.
Right.
And that's why – I mean, you know, I think Toy Story 3 is obviously about death and obviously about, like, second chances.
And religion as well.
And rebirth.
Right.
But it's also to me about, like – Yeah. And which is what I think Toy Story 2 is, the Jesse storyline. It's also to me about...
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
moving on and finding like love again, which is why I'm so, I mean, like, I'm like you when it comes to Toy Story 4. Like, my expectations are incredibly sky high, and
I'm nervous.
And I said, like,
I'm very nervous. I'm very guarded. I've been trying to prepare myself the way my father told me to for Toy Story 2, being like, you just have to accept that there will be a Toy Story movie you don't like in the world that you think is like marginal. Lately, I've been going deep into that's a good poll, right? I think Party Source is the lowest of the Hawaiian Vacation. I would put below Party Source.
Yes, I agree with that.
Short Fries, obviously, the peak. Yeah. Toy Story Terror also rules.
Yeah, that's legitimate. Yes, yeah, I agree with you. I'll watch that when I get home. But.
I found a really good, deep shit Toy Story fan blog.
Oh, boy.
Where she has just been sourcing every little tiny leak that's come out. And I've started piecing together story things in my mind that have started to make me cautiously very excited for the
movie.
Is
it the Bo Peep stuff?
The Bo Peep stuff, now that they're little drips and drabs coming out, seems really interesting to me.
Me too. Because that depressed me in Toy Story 3 that they're just like...
Yeah, they just threw her away.
Fucking fridged her. It's like...
Yeah, they totally fridged her.
It's crazy to me. But like... And I had always forgotten how... It wasn't really that she was integral to the plot of Toy Story 2. It really wasn't that. But she was kind of a Woody's secondary emotional
anchor.
She's
an emotional anchor. She very much is.
And he just kind of moved on. And I never bought it.
Right. And you have that sort of moment in 3 where he goes like, yeah, and Bo.
Yeah.
Right. I don't want to get into
this. Which is a Zurg moment for me.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Like, yes. Yeah.
Right.
Can I just say, though, she was supposed to be Barbie, correct? Bo Peep?
Correct.
And they couldn't, and Mattel just didn't want to give them. And then when they saw how big it was, Barbie's like a big part of the of the second one. And a funny part of it. I thought the whole Barbie stuff in Toy Story 2 was actually quite well done for the most part.
I agree. And in 3, I think she's even better.
Yeah.
As is Ken. They're incredible.
Yeah.
They're awesome.
But it works better because it's Bo Peep. I'll say this. This is what I'm starting to tap into. A lot of speculation on my part. But what I think 4 is circling around is Bo Peep is literally a porcelain doll in a world that abandoned her without her support system.
I'm dying.
And someone who's had to survive 20 years on her own.
Oh, wow.
Because the thing that this blog's been picking up on is all these merchandise leaks with the key art of the characters.
Yeah.
And Bo Peep has been sort of redesigned as this, like... a person who's had to figure out how to exist in a world that is made to destroy her.
Shit. I mean, listen,
I think we might be seeing Sarah Connor Bo Peep, is what I'm saying. And not in the surface sort of parody way.
Amazing.
No, as you're describing
the Bo Peep had to learn how to become a survivor when everyone who said they loved her just forgot and moved on and had a Toy Story 3
so
without
her. She's hardened.
Literally. Now, if that's what the movie's actually doing, I'm fully back on board. But I might
that
just be grasping
incredible.
At straws.
That sounds incredible.
Right?
But can I – who read the script and said it? I mean, I think it was Tim Allen, so, you know, grain of salt. But didn't he say it was like the greatest script he's ever read?
I mean, Tim – and also Tom Hanks said when he was recording some of it, couldn't he couldn't look at them.
Right. I mean, all of them are – and that scares me a little because I feel like they're just selling. Because that was like the thing that propelled 3 so much. It's like, you're not going to believe how much you cry. Like that becomes this like Pixar thing now where
I can't
believe
how much I cried.
It's so fucking sad.
I was
– Which I cried like a baby. I mean, I cried for 30 minutes straight. Me too. I truly cried for the last 30 minutes straight. I saw it 10 times in theaters. Oh, I cried so every single time.
I also want to say, and maybe I'm not great with twists as Kenny can. I don't see them coming.
Yeah.
I thought they were going to die.
Oh, so did
I thought they were melting them down at the end. I forgot about the green little aliens. Like, I completely forgot that they, and when they showed up.
On the rewatch or?
No, I'm in the theater.
In the theater.
So
they misdirect you enough that you lose
enough
track
that I completely
of them.
Forgot. Right. Yeah. And I was like, this is the end of the trilogy. They're going to melt them down. We're going to see their faces melt like the end of Raiders. And that's just how it's going to go.
Well, and what kills me is that for me, it's actually them dying would be less emotionally impactful to me than the moment where they all accept their death.
When they hold each other's hands.
That's the thing that fucking destroys me. When they all look at each other and Woody realizes he can't make excuses anymore and they just have to rely on each other. Because at the end of the day, what these Toy Story movies are about is that the only currency that actually matters is the relationships we have in our life.
Yeah.
The value you have to other people and not letting pettiness, your own insecurities, your social status, your career override those things. And Toy Story 2 is these guys being like, fuck, are my kids growing up not knowing me? Because I want to make movies that make kids happy. You know? Fuck. Like, these guys are just – like, John Lasseter's like, I had, like, 4 children in between Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2, and I had, like, not slept. I made three movies in a row. And for all his failings as a person, this movie is literally like a dad reckoning with, like, are my kids just going to be like, yeah, that's like the dude who paid for my education.
Oh.
You know?
This movie's become so much more depressing.
No, it's not
in depressing. In the best possible way.
It's cathartic. But there's – so the hint of that moment, because that's my favorite moment maybe in Pixar history. That's one of my favorite moments in movie history, the holding onto the hands, the accepting thing, the okay, we're going to die, but at least we're with dad.
Right.
Right? Which is like a terrible way to die, but that is how I would want to die.
Yeah,
like I always kind of like that moment in Deep Impact when Taya Leone standing.
Hugs her dad and the.
It's just, like, okay, if you're going to go, like, there are worse ways, I guess.
Yeah.
This movie's inciting incident is Woody's heroism to save the least consequential toy in the entire lot.
I'm getting shivers.
Yeah, you got Wheezy up there, been up there for some amount of time.
He's been written off.
He's been written off.
And everyone's already said Wheezy lost cause.
And I would have, and even watching this, because I haven't seen this movie in a very long time. Yeah. For some reason, like, this is not a movie my kids rewatch.
Yeah.
One and three are. So that's probably on me. So, but I had kind of been like, okay, so Wheezy is the casualty of this movie.
Right.
Right, and there are usually casualties of these movies, right? Yeah. Like, Bo Peep is the casualty of three. Like, and the fact that Woody is willing to risk his life
for this. For Wheezy.
No offense to Wheezy. This nobody.
Yeah.
Is so beautiful.
But it's because he sees himself in Wheezy, too.
No, it's because he's dad.
It's because I think it's both.
It's all,
I think he's on the shelf when he sees Wheezy.
That's true too.
And he's like, this guy, we're in this together. You're not going down.
Well, for the first time, he understands the Wheezy complex. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think he was a guy who was always like, sad about what happened to Wheezy. You know, we lost track of that guy.
Yeah.
But, like, at the end of the day, like, he can't actually figure out. He's already come through his arc of accepting, maybe I'm not the only toy. Yeah. But a thing he's never considered of is, what if I'm not a toy at all? Yeah. What if Andy doesn't give me any attention, let alone all the attention? Yeah. So now, for the first time, he's like, oh, fuck, this is a fate worse than death. I cannot, like, you
this
know, he's saving himself because he has to believe that someone would do the same for him in that position. Because otherwise he has nothing to believe in anymore. You know, I mean, they're sort of like their commitment to this almighty God as Andy. But he's also, as you said, just like your lover. Like, you want to believe that, like, your wife, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your husband would do the same thing for you. And Wheezy's this incredible balancing act where it's like it's somehow a parody of that type of character in a serious movie, but it also works emotionally. Like, they set it up as the old timer thing, and like the you know, the squeeze box, you know, it's broken, all that sort of stuff. And it's like the audience is laughing of like, I recognize this trope. He's the old timer, you know, he's the one who can't run anymore, whatever it is. But then it also like gets you.
There's also, I mean, you bring up the religious elements, which I really didn't think about, like Andy being a godlike figure for them, which he very much is. I mean, and then when he does save Wheezy, he says to, doesn't he say, bless you, Woody, or something like that?
Yeah.
When he puts him under Buster's collar. Like, it's just, it's, I don't know, it's a beautiful movie about people looking out for each other in a way that I think is really interesting. Something else I wanted to bring up earlier that occurred to me is that these Pixar films make it clear to kids that it's okay to be sad.
Yeah.
Like, which is so vitally important
big,
that you can't
big,
be
big.
Happy all the time. Inside Out, maybe the most explicitly.
Yeah.
But especially in this where you're like, it's okay to be depressed sometimes. Like, that's life is a
it's
roller
important.
Coaster.
And that's what
it's
kills
important.
Me is that this movie is Woody accepting
that
things are sad and that they're not going to be good forever.
Yeah.
Like, that's huge in a kid's movie. That's a crazy thing to throw out there.
It really is.
That's a very complicated thing, but
it's
like
revolutionary.
Kids, yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it really is. And like I just came back from Disneyland, Humblebrag. And the thing I was so taken by was I went there with my girlfriend, Double Humblebrag. And she had never been to Disneyland, and we were going on all the old like story dark rides, which I love.
Me too.
Just love the aesthetics and the sort of storytelling style of all those rides that we're telling you the narrative of the movie. You're going through in the slow-moving cart scene by scene. And the thing that's crazy is all of those rides choose to, because they have to greatly condense the plot, only focus on the most disturbing elements of the movie. Like it's literally called Snow White Scary Adventures, and save for the first room you go through where it's Snow White and the dwarves, the rest of it is just the witch, you know? There's a Pooh ride that's more recent that's just his, like, Heffalump nightmares. Mr. Toad's Wild Ride is just about his alcoholism. You know?
Did you go on the Roger Rabbit ride?
We didn't get to go on that.
Have you ever been on it?
I have, yes.
So scary.
They all focus on...
You're a tune who's going to get dipped. Yes,
they all of those rides focus on the darkest elements of the character's psyche. Like, they focus on the fear.
Why do you think that is?
Because I think Walt Disney understood. I don't think he was comfortable with the same level of sadness because he would do the, you know, the parent gets killed at the beginning, you start out, but you get the happily ever after at the end. I think he understood it's also important for kids to be scared. Mm. You got to scare kids. Mm. And I think Pixar, the way they evolved that was, you also have to let kids know it's okay to be sad.
You got to look into the abyss
that things,
every now and
you
then.
Have to make concessions in life. Things don't end up perfectly for everyone. Yeah. And the growth is learning to accept what your reality is.
And good, that's amazing.
Good, I mean, for some extent, you know, Walt Disney being Walt Disney and having his issues. Good on him for understanding that.
Yeah.
But it's a lot less brave. I mean, to some extent, like, you know, my son...
It's more binary, too.
And yeah, he undercuts it by they always defeat the bad guy and the ending is super happy.
My son once said, and, you know, this is a bit of a humble brag, too. he likes scary movies. And I asked him why, and he said, because they make me brave. Which is, it was very simple.
That's very great. Profound. It was,
it never even occurred to me, but that's the answer, right? Yeah, the answer is just dealing with this scary stuff, getting over in the context of a safe space and moving forward. It never occurred to me as a storyteller, as a story watcher, the importance of sadness. This is embarrassing because I had been doing it for a long time until I watched Inside Out.
Yeah.
Inside Out put it in front of you plainly, and I have such great appreciation for doing that for me as a storyteller and as a parent and as a person.
Yeah.
It's important to explain to your kids that it's okay to feel your emotions. And to your point, no one anywhere had done that. Forget children's movies.
Yeah.
I can't think of a movie.
That summed up the entire phenomenon better than I had ever seen it summed up in any medium or any form by any person.
Right.
Where I was just like, oh, we fundamentally need to be sad.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And there's the moment I saw that movie with my friend Jess Lane. And the moment where Joy, like, puts the chalk circle around sadness and goes like, so this is your circle, just stay here. She went, oh, fuck. And I went, what? And she went, oh, Jesus Christ, that's what this movie's, oh, my God. Yeah. And it wasn't like she was angry, but she was like, oh, fuck, now I know what the next 90 minutes of my life is going to be. Because she just immediately got what they were doing and was like, oh, fuck, that is heavy.
It's perfectly distilled, though. Like, it's for a child to be able to understand it as well.
But
I don't know,
grown up, too. That's what – so to this point – all right, so the Toy Story thing and the Inside Out thing. Because, you know, we're – I don't know if anyone told you, Griffin, we're planning on doing our top five Pixar. We just assumed you had them at the ready.
Yeah, it shifts constantly, but I could rattle them off at
this
moment.
Off.
Yeah.
For Toy Story, the quote you read about Roger Ebert in the beginning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
About the nature of having a toy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a toy when I was growing up called Soldier, and Soldier went with me everywhere. Mm-hmm. And
Was it a soldier?
It was a little plush soldier. Okay. I mean, it was, you know.
Just making sure.
Yeah, it was a little plush soldier. And
plush soldier is interesting.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
It was kind of knit. Like, there was nothing like...
Wow, yeah.
There was nothing kind of factory line about this thing.
Sure. Yeah.
Not that makes me cool that I had some, like, you know...
I love that you called it Soldier, because I had a bear that I called Bear.
Yeah.
It's just there's something very, I don't know, very nice about that idea.
So Soldier...
I had Big Dog and Little Dog.
Sure.
So Soldier over the everywhere. And one, I lost Soldier at a hotel once, and it was devastating, and... The hotel actually sent it back, which was, you know, being reunited.
Right.
And then not having Soldier anymore really broke my heart. I never considered that anybody else in the world had that relationship with a toy.
I think that's why the first time I saw that trailer, it hit me so profoundly that, like, this is my movie. Yeah. Where it's like, this is what I'm thinking about all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then this movie, too, does such a good job of just being like, there is so much meat on this bone.
Yeah.
And it does so much, like, really smart, like, if this, then that, you know? And just deepens the whole notion, the sort of existential reality of these characters and all these new ideas. I mean, from both directions, like, you know, going, what are other phenomenons that happen to a toy? Being broken, never leaving the packaging. You know, what are conditions? What are places toys can come from?
Yeah. What are places they go?
Right. And how do all these... you know, different relationships formed them. I mean, the Jessie thing is, like, so upsetting when you start engaging with it because you just go, like, oh, fuck, she was, like, in a box for, like, decades?
Like she was a toy decades. From the 50s, right? 50s or 60s.
Right, right. Yeah.
And I have done that to my toys.
Yeah.
Like, I have so many toys, and I don't have them anymore because they've probably been incinerated, that I have done that to.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's a question for you.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the Emily theory? Have you read about the fact that
the mom... Andy's mom?
Is it a little... I think it's a little too neat.
I think so, too. I don't think that was intended by them at all. Okay. I think it's too neat.
I didn't think so either, but I mean...
Weirdly, like, people just love these fucking thick Pixar theories.
It's so weird. Some of them are really weird. The Andy's really dad weird. Thing is really weird.
Oh, but I think that's true. That the divorce that they were...
No, there's a theory about the dad... I'm sure you've heard about this. Maybe, the dad died, this and there's theory. A whole weird... Do you want to explain it in more detail?
The dad had polio, right?
Yeah, and Woody's actually a one-of-a-kind toy.
Produced it, and it was a prototype he won in a contest.
You got to really want it.
That's a bad theory. I don't like that.
You got to really want it.
To me, I mean, it's obvious. I think it's text that he's the child of divorce.
She's a single mom, for sure.
And there is this inference you get where it's just like that was his dad's toy.
Yeah,
you know, even before you get to two and they make it clear, like, oh, it's that old, when now clearly this must have been a hand-me-down.
Yeah.
Even in one, you're just like, this feels like this doll is a connection to his father who's not there anymore. Yeah, this is now the main male figure in his life, is this idea of Sheriff Woody protecting the town, looking out for everyone around him.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of him being the leader of the room, which then he also literally is.
Yeah. It's We should probably talk about the plot.
So who do one last thing. If that's all true, which I think it is, does that make Buzz like the cool stepdad? Is Buzz cool? I mean, is he Will Ferrell in Daddy's Home?
Well, no, I think you're saying in your metaphor he's Mark Wahlberg in Daddy's
Home. Well, Mark Wahlberg is the original dad. But you
maybe he's John Cena.
It doesn't work for you. Exactly right. I mean, it doesn't work perfectly because the cool one, yes, he's John Cena.
John Cena, who would play Buzz Lightyear in live action.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. He's built like Buzz Lightyear.
I see looking at the whole trilogy or the whole franchise through Woody's lens, which is clearly what they're doing, whatever. But I always can relate to Buzz Lightyear's reckoning with, you know, the world of Zurg, the world of you know, Space Captain Buzz Lightyear is not real. But this is real. I'm accepting this and fitting in really well. I don't know. I do hope we put some time to talk about Buzz.
Absolutely. I mean, I we'll bake in a lot of this stuff as we get through the plot, as you know.
I mean, you said, just the conceit of how, like, you know, they said, okay, we have this character who's so much fun in the first movie in his delusion.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of and you hear all the casting choices they had before, and there's the animated, like, reels you can see where it was, like, Billy Crystal – and they thought it was like a comedian, you know, doing their shtick.
Yeah.
And the Tim Allen casting choice, which is like, he's not my favorite guy.
No.
He was after this movie briefly, you know?
Sure, sure.
But like now I'm not like some Tim Allen acolyte.
He did have a big year in 99, Galaxy Quest and Toy Story 2. I mean,
kills it in both of them.
Kind of him at his peak.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, his two best performances.
Yeah.
But like this isn't the performance that you would think casting the Home Improvement guy would give you.
I agree.
And it's surprising that he plays it so straight. That he doesn't play it like a comedian. He plays it like an action star, you know?
Well, that's key.
Key. I mean, he's doing his kind of Shatner.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Which, you know, it's funny. So a couple weeks ago we did Bicentennial Man with Todd Vanderwerf and his wife Libby. And
the great Todd. The great Libby.
The great Todd. The great Libby.
Yeah.
And Tim Allen was apparently in the conversation to play...
Well, Disney was character. Like all in on him at this
like,
point. Yeah.
I imagine he would have played it like Buzz Lightyear. Like that's how I imagine he would have played.
It would have been a better movie, actually. Like it just
relitigate.
That's kind of a nightmare movie.
It's a total nightmare movie.
It just I don't know. Robin Williams not to relitigate it. He was in a weird place in his career where he really was trying to win an Oscar, and that movie shouldn't have been anywhere near an Oscar conversation. If there was someone who's bringing a little more Santa Claus to it.
I just think that the Tim Allen lane is pretty narrow.
Yeah.
And listen, he's good at what he does.
And look, Galaxy Quest is the same thing. It's like he's weirdly – when he becomes the like blue collar, like grunt man thing, you kind of go like, I got a lot of this. I get my fill really quickly.
Yeah.
But when he's kind of commenting on it and he's playing these like innately kind of broken lost people with the facade of the confidence, he's really good. He's also really good in Red Belt. The Mammoth movie?
Oh, I never saw that.
Which Mammoth is like obsessed with Galaxy Quest.
Sure.
He's like, it's one of the five best screenplays ever written. He's always like, it's like, you know, it's like 12 Angry Men, A Place in the Sun, Galaxy Quest. These are the perfect movies.
That's fantastic.
And he like,
it is a great movie.
It's an incredible movie. Yeah. But he kind of got that's the Tim Allen lane where he's really valuable. And they said they cast him because he was like the big sitcom guy at the moment, not expecting that he would play the character that way, that it would be that much of like the sort of the army guy, you know?
There's a metatextualism to the way that he approaches it, to your point, where he's like, he which is not something he does a lot, but he does it incredibly well here. And I think Tom Hanks is doing it as well with Woody. Like, I think that there's an acknowledgement of the layers of these characters and what they're a commentary on.
Right.
Like, I think Tom Hanks understands that he's doing, and forgive me, what is the character, the kid's character?
Oh, Howdy Doody.
Howdy Doody. You know what I mean? Like, that's sort of what he's doing.
Yeah.
And you have to also wonder on the Katzenberg side, if he was instrumental in getting Tom Hanks I would just imagine that Tom Hanks couldn't have been easy to get in this. He's never done anything like this before.
Yeah.
And I think my assessment, and again, obviously I'll never know, but Tom Hanks approaches this role to be able to do things that he doesn't necessarily want to do in live action anymore.
And I think it's also the same thing with Tim Allen, where it's like, this is a role that he couldn't play physically.
Yes. Yes.
But it's also, just one other little point on that.
Yeah.
This was a lane that didn't exist.
Yeah.
So you look at Disney, like, you had some people in The Lion King.
Yeah.
But no one of Tom Hanks' caliber.
No. Well,
and they tell the stories, like he always said in interviews, they offered him the part and he said, like, absolutely not. I don't sing. You know, and that was the immediate thought. And they had to explain to him it's not a musical. So I think that alone probably makes him lean in.
Yeah.
And they had done this thing, which then they popularized of like, let's take an audio clip from one of their films and animate it. And he saw, I think, how much they were adding performance-wise. You know, I mean, Tim Allen tells the story about seeing Toy Story 1 in the theater, and there's the scene when they're trapped under the milk crate.
Yep.
In Sid's room, and Woody tries to give the motivational speech, and now it's a Buzz who now realizes he's a toy and is having an existential crisis and realizes he has no value in the world, or thinks that he has no value in the world if he's not actually a space ranger. And Woody gives the speech where he's like, you're Buzz Lightyear, the coolest toy in the world. And it's just Buzz's reaction shots as he's sort of processing it. And Tim Allen says he sat there at the premiere and went, God, I'm good in this movie. And then realize that the character has no dialogue in the scene.
Right.
You know? But I think the performances are so linked in this.
Yeah.
And I think Toy Story 2 in particular, part of, I think, the mad dash to make this movie, how overworked everyone is, the character animation in this is really weird. Like, the characters are very manic. And they also just kind of feel like they're going insane. I mean, that first...
They've been in boxes for 50 years.
I mean, the first moment with Jesse, I just think it's some of the best character animation in the history of the medium, where you have that sort of mad dash of Woody in the room, Bullseye giving him the mad run, and then Jesse does that, like, super manic, like, Woody, the prospector, he'll want to meet you! And she's sort of, like, whipping him around, you know? And then there's the bit where they play out Woody's roundup, and Woody does his, like, fake, you know, sort of movie star John Wayne walk, and all that sort of stuff. Ugh. It's just, like, they totally abandoned all rules of how animated performances were supposed to work, which were often mostly based in cuteness or prettiness.
Yeah, like, even the prospector's first, turn me around so I can see him.
Yeah.
And you're just like, there's a weight in this film.
And literally, I just remember in that first scene being so taken by his mouth posture.
Yes. Yes.
You know, you're like, I mean, the juxtaposition of, here's this character who's like this like old fool, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so funny when you finally watch the clip of a thing.
Yep.
And you're like, oh, he's like, why am I not thinking of the guy's name? But he's like a Walter Brennan, like, God, oh, no! You know?
Yeah.
And that he's this like very serious Shakespearean sort of dude.
There's also the line when they say, you're out of your box.
Yeah.
Like, that's you've gone crazy in some way, that you're out of your box. Yeah. But everyone is out of their box.
Which is what has happened to him
to
some extent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think about the line you're talking about, you know, the prospector making the argument for why being in Japan is a good idea. Brock Spencer's never felt what any of these characters have felt.
No.
He's never felt love.
Oh, he's like a sociopath. I mean, he's like, he's had to tell himself that it's just about his career.
Yeah.
Because he's never had a good relationship in his life. You know, whereas Woody is like debating, you know, in the same way that like Jesse is, where it's like, I've like loved and lost before. Like, I don't know if I can go through that again. Just having like a guarantee that people are going to love you on a minute-to-minute basis is better for me than the idea of like you might get 5 great years. You know, I'd rather have like 100 okay ones. Which is like why, you know, in this business, I think a lot of us have seen these people where it's just like, oh, that's like your whole modus operandi is like, can you make stuff that makes people cheer when you come out on stage? You know, and they prioritize that above everything else. And it's like, that's a fucking drug.
Yeah.
And that's you'll never get your fix. You will never get your fix.
The depressing aspect of the prospector is he didn't make a choice.
No, he didn't make a choice.
He didn't make a choice. Right. He's like that Jet Li character in that movie where he's made to be a dog. Remember with Bob Hoskins?
Unleashed.
Unleashed.
Yes.
I never saw that movie.
I never saw that movie.
I saw that trailer, and I can't watch a movie like that. But I saw that trailer, and that got to me so much. This idea of, look, Edward Scissorhands is kind of like this too. This idea that someone was created for a certain purpose that has nothing to do with what it means to live a life.
Well, and when we talk about those people who we all know who can't fill that void and are constantly obsessively seeking for it, most of them you're just like, my parents never got me. You know, it wasn't even like, oh, I grew up in an abusive household. I grew up just kind of neglected.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the prospector's thing where it's just like, this is like a cruel world.
Yeah.
No one's out there for you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's he's very nihilistic. I mean, there's no question. He just seems sort of – he's kind of got a one-track mind. You also would imagine, too, you know, this has been the end goal for a long time, right?
Like, right.
Woody coming into this equation is the final piece of the puzzle, right? So how long Wayne Knight has been putting together this group of toys – it's a very long time, and he's just like, we're fucking going to Japan, and I don't give a shit what it takes to get there.
Right, and to a degree, I mean, this is going to be sweaty, but you know, Prospector is kind of like one of these, you know, red pill guys who tries to win the argument through, like, intellectual clarity.
Right.
You know, like, you're letting emotions get in the way. Right. We're human beings. We're not supposed to be monogamous. You know, women are subservient. Like, he's making that kind of argument, which is just like, kids aren't a thing.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be going after kids. That's not the name of the game, you know? And that's why he's got this whole air of pretension around him. Kelsey Grammer's such smart casting.
Oh, it's incredible casting.
Because it is that thing of just, like, Kelsey Grammer is always creepy, you know? Yeah. And even when, like, it's so weird that he became such a beloved sitcom star because Frasier is so fucking prickly.
So weird.
Is such an asshole.
it's weird.
So unpleasant and is so condescending and elitist. Yeah. And they're just like, we're just going to make him the villain finally. We're finally going to make Kelsey Grammer. And you fall for it because you're like, oh, it's the Kelsey Grammer type. It's this elitist kind of cold guy. But of course, we're supposed to love him.
Yeah.
And then when the movie gives you the twist, you're like, well, I didn't sniff it out because I just thought that was the archetype we were going
Well, with. I mean, the Kelsey Grammer, God, I love this podcast. The Kelsey Grammer thing is so great because Kelsey Grammer walks into Cheers a Broken Man.
Right.
So he's already he's spent a whole life being that asshole, being the guy in Goodwill Hunting Bob.
Right.
You know, talking down to all the townies.
Right.
But he's already been broken down.
They give him like a 4-episode arc as the conflict. Like he's literally just there to be the competition.
Yeah.
And then because they like him so much, they want him on the show, but the only way to justify him being on the show is he's broken now.
Yeah.
Like, he is fundamentally broken by this relationship, and now he can't leave this fucking bar where the woman who left him at the altar...
serving drinks.
With the man who she left him for. And he wants to sit there all the time.
It's incredible.
Right, and then even when he finds, like, you know, his new, like, love in his life, when he finds Lilith, he's like, cool, we're gonna hang out at this bar all the time. I'm bringing you to this bar where I'm constantly faced with my own rejection. What was probably the greatest failure in my life. And there is that seething resentment in him.
So you take that character, which we all know, I mean, which we've all come to kind of trust.
Right, I have a superior intellect. You don't understand.
There's also a modulation to Kelsey Grammer's voice. Mm-hmm. He can be quite soft and quite soothing.
Yeah.
And then he turns it and you're like, oh, you're a fucking sociopath.
That's that, like, you know, like, oh, like Kelsey Grammer is like a theatrically trained guy. Yeah, like this is like, you know, a guy who thought he was going to be on the stage and not be a leading man in like TV or movies, you know?
Well, that's the Sideshow Bob. And he just,
he's got such control over his voice as an instrument.
So the Sideshow Bob of it to me was always like, same with Frasier. Like,
right.
If you have this, like, it's almost like Frasier, you know, kind of scary black version.
Yeah.
Dark version.
Excuse me. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good clarification.
Well, just let that be.
Yeah. You
know,
yeah.
Put it out there raw. Yeah. You know, this is just me. If you give this guy an inch, if you give this guy a mile, you don't know what he's going to take. And not to – I bring it back to Trump every episode. But there was a period – I mean, I can't help myself.
Yeah.
But there was a period of time when he was doing The Apprentice when everyone was like, yeah, he's not so bad. He's not so bad. Let's let him around parties. Let's have him sit with Megan Mullally at the fucking Emmys.
Right.
Like, he's part of this team now because he's been beaten down. He's had his bankruptcies.
Right.
He's kind of relatable now. He's kind of adorable now. Keep him around.
We're all in on the joke, I guess.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah. Right. And he's kind of in, too, was kind of the idea. I mean, the Megan Mullally thing at the Emmys was a perfect example of, like, Trump has been humbled. He's allowed to hang out in this role, and look what happens. And I think that's this Kelsey
Grammer
thing.
Everyone treated him like he was Frasier rather than like Kelsey Grammer.
Yes.
Like they got so into the idea of the character now that he was recontextualized as like, oh, he's like a parody of a rich person.
Yeah, a parody of an intellectual person.
Right, and it's like at that point it's like having like Bart Simpson present at the Emmys. You know?
Which I think is happening.
You're like, oh, it's like a cool technical trick that they're doing the character live.
Yeah.
You know?
It's amazing. So, that's the end of part one of our episode on Toy Story 2 with Griffin Newman. We hope you're enjoying it so far.
Yeah, we know you are. in part two, we continue this discussion, obviously. We
get more into plot.
More into plot. We talk about our favorite
Pixar
movies.
Probably get to the actual plot, I imagine.
And then we do, that's my dog. And then we do 20 to 30 minutes on the Oscars.
We actually do that, yeah.
So, in 99 and
then we talk about other episodes that Griffin might come on for.
We do a lot of great
stuff. We do a lot of stuff.
It's so much fun.
It's a mixed bag of greatness.
And as I alluded to at the end of the last podcast, the blank check episode where maybe saying Griffin Newman is an American treasure is the episode they did on Halle Meyer-Shire's classic Home Again.
Classic.
A movie I absolutely adore, and Phil thinks not good.
I mean, it's got some stuff
and
in
the guys loved, for all the reasons I love it, and also
movie's insane.
I happen to know a lot about the making of that movie. I will not divulge why, and Griffin nailed specific things about what the inspirations for certain characters were that were almost uncanny to me because they were not obvious, but they were perfect. So that was fun. Part two's great. We love you, Griffin. We like you, Blankies, who are just checking us out. Please come back.
Please come back
for part two.
Please come back for part two. I'm at PM Iskov on Twitter and Instagram. We are at Podcast Like 1999 on Twitter. Kenny is at Nybart. Please rate, review, subscribe, and please come back for part two next week.
Griffin is at Griff Lightning, as you know.
Yes. Thank you. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's ARMODILO.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.